The program regularly scheduled will not be heard at this time in order that we may bring you a talk by Henry A. Wallace, candidate of the Progressive Party for the presidency of the United States, for whom NBC has made this free time available. Mr. Wallace.
The Congress has reassembled in Washington. It has been called into special session by President Truman to create the illusion that it is the Congress and the Congress alone which is responsible for the sorry state of our national affairs. President Truman did not call this present special session with any expectation of getting legislation which would serve the American people. He called it in the mistaken belief that he could make Congress a scapegoat for his own inadequate and often dangerous leadership. Mr. Truman knew that a Congress which had worked hand in glove with his administration in scuttling price controls, in setting the stage for anti-labor legislation, in whipping up false Red Scares, and in giving service to international big business, Mr. Truman knew that such a Congress would not suddenly reform in the heat of the midsummer in Washington. He was completely confident that nothing of real significance would happen. If he had not been confident, he would not have proposed, nor would his backers have permitted him to propose, legislation which faintly imitates the measures for which progressives have been fighting these past 2 years. As a professional politician, as a graduate of the Pendergast machine, as a close student of the utterly corrupt Democratic Party machinery, Mr. Truman was completely confident that he could hoodwink millions of Americans with a gesture of calling a special session. This was a coldly calculated maneuver to create the election year impression that there is a real struggle between the two old parties. Nothing would please me more than to find honest reasons for believing that the president wants to fight for progressive measures. But the evidence is all to the contrary. The insincerity of his performance is apparent when we realize the things which Mr. Truman might have done, could still do, but will not do to provide real leadership in solving some of the major problems of the people. Mr. Truman could pick up the presidential pen from his desk and provide genuine leadership. This very day, he could request and receive the resignations of his own lieutenants, who are so largely responsible for milk at 24 cents a quart, meat at $1.30 a pound, and once low-priced automobiles at $2,000. He could remove the banker, John Snyder, as Secretary of the Treasury. It was Mr. Snyder who first broke the dike. It was Mr. Snyder who set off the post-war inflation when he granted the steel monopoly a $5 a ton increase while OPA was still on the statute books. He could remove the myriads of Wall Street and military representatives with whom he has completely undermined the Roosevelt policy of using government to serve the people. There is James Forrestal, the Secretary of Defense, a leading architect of the Cold War, who is a graduate of Dillon Reed, the investment banking house, so concerned with rebuilding the industrial empire of the Nazi cartelists. He could remove Mr. Forrestal, whose insatiable appetite for bigger and better arms programs is a leading source of the very inflation about which the president purports to worry. From the State Department alone, he could evict such leading representatives of the big business philosophy as the Undersecretary of State Robert Lovett, formerly of the investment banking firm of Brown Brothers Harriman, and Assistant Secretary of State Charles Saltzman, former Vice President of the New York Stock Exchange. From the key defense posts under Forrestal, he could remove all those men who are sensitive to the desires of big business for highly profitable contracts for arms, munitions, and aircraft. There is the industrialist Secretary of the Air Force, W. Stuart Symington, and his assistant, Cornelius Vanderbilt Whitney. There is the Secretary of the Army, Kenneth Royal, who serves as chairman of the board and as a director and officer of a number of corporations. And the Undersecretary of the Army, General William Draper, Jr., another graduate of the Dillon Reed banking firm. In the past 3 years, it has become almost impossible to go to any key office in Washington without meeting an industrialist, a banker, or a general. These are not evil men, but they are unfitted by their personal interests to hold the key administrative posts in a government which should be of the people, by the people, and for the people. These men have dominated the administration. They led Mr. Truman into the policy of the Cold War, into the scuttling of necessary economic controls after VJ Day, and if they remain quiet now, it is to enable their man, Mr. Truman, to build a myth that he is fighting valiantly in the people's interests. They share his confidence that nothing will result except the perpetuation of an illusion that there is a difference between the two monopoly parties. If Mr. Truman were sincere about fighting inflation, he would rid himself of the men whose advice led him to feed the fires of inflation. He has not replaced them. He has not reprimanded them when they have contradicted his own statements. He has kept them in the most important posts of our national government. In keeping these men, he is showing the same insincerity which leads him to speak against commodity speculation and yet retain on his personal staff the proven speculator, Brigadier General Wallace Graham. But the most appalling evidence of the president's insincerity in presenting his pseudo-liberal program to Congress is found in his own actions on the much-discussed civil rights program. With the same pen that could eliminate the Wall Street domination of the executive department, Mr. Truman, tonight, could end segregation in the armed forces. This past week, as the Congress convened in Washington to receive his message, the president took a step which mocked the hopes of all democracy-loving Americans, and most particularly the 15 million Negro Americans who are this nation's most subjugated minority. He issued an executive order which ostensibly afforded a new status to the Negro soldier, sailor, airman, and marine. This order, though it created headlines, and through headlines an illusion, did not end Jim Crow, did not abolish segregation in the armed forces. Mr. Truman's chief of staff has already made it clear that the new order will not end segregation in the armed forces. The fault is not with the chief of staff, but with President Truman. Mr. Truman used the language of the Southern Bourbon, the language of the defenders of the Jim Crow tradition, by calling for equal opportunity and equal treatment. The Southern Bourbons have always mouthed phrases like separate but equal facilities in their defense of Jim Crow, though the words separate and equal are inherently contradictory. Mr. Truman used language which appeased his Secretary of the Army, Kenneth Royal, who threatened to resign if segregation in the Army were abolished. He used language which appeased those arch defenders of the caste system, the generals of the Army. In another heartless dodge this week, he appointed a commission to investigate that which has been investigated time and time again, discrimination in federal employment. He resurrected the nauseating practice of the British imperialists and other oppressors from time immemorial, the device of the investigating commission. The colonial peoples of the world will understand Mr. Truman's dodge. The people of Israel, who saw 21 investigations used to delay justice for them, will understand. And the Negro people of the United States will see through this shabby political performance. The emergencies in housing, inflated prices, in health and education, which the president now recognizes so dramatically, existed when the regular session of Congress adjourned in June. If the president were sincere, he would have called a special session on the day he signed the anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic Displaced Persons Bill. If he were sincere, he would not have signed that bill. He would have thrown it back in the faces of Congress and told them to come back into session after the political convention, to come back and pass a decent bill which would admit the homeless of all races, national origins, and creeds. The sad, simple, shocking fact is that Mr. Truman's call for a special session did not come from a deep conviction that he must serve the people. It came from a belated conviction that he must do something dramatic to fool the people in an effort to split the progressive forces. But what looks like a short-run political success will prove the final undoing of the Janus-faced one-party system. The special session will demonstrate that even if the president were sincerely dedicated to serving the general welfare, he could not succeed. Tied as he is to a corrupt, machine-ridden, monopoly-controlled political party. Though it will not take action to curb monopoly and serve the fundamental interests of the people, the special session of the Congress is not without value. It will dramatize the need for the political realignment which is taking place, the alignment which will put reactionary votes in the Dewey column and progressive votes in the progressive column. It will dramatize the fact that the only wasted votes in November will be those cast for the Truman ticket. It will demonstrate that no party can long exist half Hague and half free. The special session, like the civil rights program before it, resulted from the demonstrations that the American people are determined to maintain their traditional freedoms, their living standards, and that they are determined to end the Cold War. While both old parties recognize this demand, their battle is a sham. Both pretend that they want to stop inflation and contend that they only disagree on methods. The Republicans say the way to stop inflation is to reduce government spending, yet they overwhelmingly support the huge appropriations for unproductive arms, the very expenditures which sap the strength of our economy and promote inflation. Mr. Dewey, the leader of the Republican Party, smugly and silently sits in Albany while the special session meets. But Dewey gave his approval to the Republican tactics in Congress. He approves the Republicans getting out in front to block Truman's demagogic request for price controls, while the Democrats get out in front to block the equally demagogic requests of the Republicans for civil rights legislation. Mr. Dewey's silence does not absolve him as a candidate from sharing his party's guilt in cooperating with the Democrats to scuttle price controls, to prevent low-cost housing, and to prosecute the inflation-breeding Cold War. No, Mr. Dewey, it won't work. The voters will see that you are no cure for the Taft-Truman inflation. The Democrats speak of controls, of price and wage controls, consumer credit controls, but the kind of selective controls which Mr. Truman proposes would not halt runaway prices. The Truman program is a sham, and it stands in marked contrast to a real anti-inflation program like that introduced in the last session of Congress by Senator Glenn Taylor. Even if Mr. Truman's program were enacted by the Congress, fuel oil, which would cost you at the most 9 cents a gallon, would still be costing you 13 cents per gallon. And the price of beef, which could be cut 20 cents a pound without reducing the farmer's net income, would stand where it is or go even higher. The prices of other commodities would probably continue to rise if the Truman plan of selective controls were enacted into law. There is no provision for an immediate freezing of prices. It relies on the establishment of an administrative machine which would take several months to assemble. And along with Truman's request for authority to impose some price ceilings goes the request for power to impose wage ceilings. This is the fly in Mr. Truman's ointment. The workers of America know that the big businessmen who would be appointed by either the Republicans or the Democrats to administer bipartisan price control would use the wage controls very liberally, the price control powers very speedily, very sparingly. No, Mr. Truman, it won't work. The man who, like Taft, called price control a police state measure isn't really going to halt inflation. Both Dewey and Truman are ready for more, not less inflation. When Mr. Dewey demands more bloodshed in China, he demands more inflation. When Mr. Truman demands more bloodshed in Greece, he demands more inflation. This root cause of inflation cannot be overemphasized. The fundamental fact for every wage earner, farmer, housewife, independent businessman to recognize is that the Republicans and Democrats both stand solidly behind the basic policies which cause inflation. They agree on the bipartisan policy of the Cold War, on the program for militarizing our economy. They have demonstrated their agreement on the policy of turning the government over to the representatives of international big business. Jim Forrestal's Mr. Truman and Winthrop Aldrich's Tom Dewey may disagree on who should get the lion's share of profits from inflation. They may reflect disagreements between Forrestal's Dillon Reed and Aldrich's Chase National, between one investment banking house and another, between one industrial empire and another, but there is no disagreement which will lead either political servant to adopt policies which would genuinely serve the American people. Both parties have said that partisan politics must stop at the water's edge, that our foreign policy is not subject to fundamental debate. With such an attitude, neither of the old parties can cope with our domestic problems, because in this world today, it is the Cold War which dictates our manner of living. It is this policy on which they agree, the policy of guns instead of butter, of tanks instead of tractors, of bullets instead of medicine, which makes inflation inevitable. If any further proof were needed that the Cold War is the basic cause of inflation, and that neither the Truman administration or the Republican Party is interested in tackling inflation, the events of the past few months would supply it. Early this year, after the break in commodity markets, there were many predictions that the inflation was at an end. The big business interests who pull the strings of government did not like this prospect. They called on their man Truman to do something about it. He did. He gave the inflation wheel another whirl. In his crisis message of March 17, in which he asked for the draft and universal military training, and in which he paved the way for increased military appropriations, Mr. Truman not only failed to call for price curbs, but went so far as to say that we must be prepared to pay the price for meeting his crisis. As I warned at the time, and as all the leading financial papers pointed out, the Truman March 17 program was bound to support, not curb, inflation. The inflationary wave he set off then has continued unchecked. In the last few months alone, the price of meat has risen 10 to 20 cents a pound, the price of steel, $10 to $30 a ton, and the price of automobiles from $100 to $200 each. The monopolists have permitted Mr. Truman to make a show of combating inflation because they know that their present power in Congress makes effective action impossible, and because they are worried lest the wrath of the people express itself in votes for the one party, the Progressive Party, which is dedicated to the fundamental job of controlling monopolists. As part of the sham battle, the Republicans and Democrats are leveling charges at one another. Last evening, Senator Taft charged that Mr. Truman is trying to regiment the country and to set up a police state with his special session program. The fact is that both old parties are trying to regiment the country, to initiate a police state, but Truman's program has very little to do with it. The other day, the Federal Trade Commission, an independent government agency not yet corrupted by bipartisan appointees, sent a special message to Congress. The commission warned that the growth of monopoly threatened this country with collectivism, with the extinction of competitive enterprise. This warning will fall on deaf ears. The bipartisan Congress and the bipartisan administration will not tackle the fundamental problems of monopoly control of our economy because old parties, both of them, are the servants of monopoly. 8 months ago, in another special session called by Truman, the Congress passed and Truman signed a law giving the monopoly corporations powers to establish cartels for the control of basic raw materials. This law gives Big Steel and Big Oil the power to regiment all of American business dependent on oil and steel. It gives them the power to create further shortages, and through shortages, to raise prices. The National Association of Manufacturers and its political stooges, both Republican and Democratic, who cry communism every time a measure essential to protect the people is proposed, are the real advocates of collectivization. The only political party in the United States today which is dedicated to preserving independent business enterprise and to protecting farmers, workers, and consumers from monopoly is the new party, the Progressive Party. The men who cry loudest against regimentation here at home are blatantly demanding regimentation in Western Europe. The truth is that they are ardent advocates of regimentation both at home and abroad. Today, Averill Harriman, a Democrat, and Paul Hoffman, a Republican, are in Europe trying to force reluctant governments to adopt detailed 4-year plans for production and foreign trade, plans which will serve international big business rather than the great mass of people either here or abroad. The attempted regimentation of Europe is being carried out under the same bipartisan auspices as the relatively silent regimentation of America. Already our foreign trade is being curtailed by a mass of red tape and stringent licensing requirements which favor large corporate interests to the growing exclusion of independent traders. Today, the government, run by the generals and big business, controls as much as 1/4 of all the goods made in our country. It's only the beginning. The Republicans, who sound like economic anarchists, and the Democrats, who sound like economic radicals, are jointly following in action the tried and tested methods of the European cartelists who regimented Germany and most of Europe in bringing on World War II. The Wall Street bankers and industrialists, the international big businessmen, have set the stage to absolve themselves of guilt for bringing us to the verge of another war. They arranged for acquittal in mock war crimes trials of their German cartel partners. Only this morning, most of the world was shocked to learn that an American military tribunal has absolved of plotting World War II the 24 top officials of IG Farben. This is the industrial monopoly which provided Hitler with his chemicals and with the special gases for the murder of millions of civilians in Nazi death chambers. We cannot help but ask, was the tragic explosion in the giant IG Farben works yesterday the result of Farben preparations for more mass asphyxiations in World War III? We may not learn the answer for a long time, since the accident will undoubtedly be whitewashed by authorities. But we know the pattern of events. First, the leaders of Krupp, the Steel King, then Hugo Stinnes, the big Ruhr operator, and now the IG Farben officials, all of them freed to help recreate the pre-war cartels we were pledged to abolish. I must warn the American people to guard against new bipartisan tricks in this special session of Congress. I must warn against the possible passage by Congress and the signing by Truman of legislation which will not stop inflation, but only increase the power of the monopolists and the militarists. I must warn the rabbits which Congress and the administration may pull out of their hats. Russian menace rabbits, red menace rabbits, Thomas Committee rabbits, they may try again, as they have done before, to hypnotize us with these hysterical sideshows while they take the next steps in the drive toward war. As a member of Truman's cabinet, I opposed the premature lifting of the controls which paved the way for killing OPA. Senator Taylor stood almost alone in combating the anti-labor hysteria bred by President Truman at the time of the railroad strike, the hysteria which led to Taft-Hartley. In the House of Representatives, the men who have allied themselves with the Progressive Party, as well as a few who are progressives at heart, but who are still wearing old party labels, have consistently fought for the kind of price and economic controls which would benefit the people, not the corporations. We progressives have consistently fought against the bipartisan policy of Cold War, the root of inflation and fear, against the policy of Cold War which drains the resources we need for housing, health, education, and social security. Many of those who have formed the new Progressive Party, the Anti-Monopoly Party, the Human Rights Party, have fought at risk of prison terms and in face of threatened violence to break down the bars of segregation. The Progressive Party has not and will not equivocate in fighting for full justice for all Americans. This is the talk big, do little Congress. The Republicans talk big about ending the poll tax and lynch law, but they don't mean it. The Democrats talk big about ending inflation and building houses. They don't mean it either. It is all shadowboxing. The American people have had enough of red herrings. They are entitled to more red meat. But the bipartisans will continue the Cold War, will continue the basic cause of inflation until the people demonstrate their independence of the old parties of the monopolists and militarists. Today, the government with its war policy directly and indirectly gives employment to more than 5 million men. If these 5 million Americans were working for peace instead of war, prices would be going down right now. But that would mean that both the Republicans and Democrats would have to forego the luxury of using the Red Menace as their chief political asset. They would have to abandon their friends in the great corporations. They would have to turn their backs on scarcity, monopoly, and war, and instead embrace the philosophy of abundance and peace. Neither old party will do this. That is why the Progressive Party is so all-important. The legislation proposed for this special session of Congress by the Progressive Party would stop inflation, would advance civil rights, would serve the people. The real progressives have consistently fought for the people in and out of Congress. The old parties have not landed a single solid blow on behalf of the people. Only the Progressive Party packs a real wallop. We have both the old parties screaming with anguish and using their servants of the press to launch vicious attacks on the Progressive Party. But we glory in their abuse. It is a measure of the essential worth of our program to curb monopoly and strike at the very roots of the people's problems. If you ask me, as an economist, as a businessman, as a farmer, what you can do to protect yourself against the mounting inflation, I can give no easy, get-rich-quick formula. If you ask me as a citizen what you can do about housing shortages, about security for your old age, about civil rights, about all of the pressing problems of the day, I can only give one honest answer. Use your ballot. It is your only real weapon against mounting inflation, eventual depression, and war. Use your ballot to help build the only party which has a real program for solving the fundamental problems of the people. I speak of the Progressive Party. I speak of the party which stands for an America where 60 million people are producing houses, not bombers, autos, not machine guns, washing machines, not tanks, an America where prices are going down and wages are going up, an abundant America in a peaceful world.
You have just heard a talk by Henry A. Wallace. Free time has been made available by the National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations to present this program, which came to you from New York. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.